Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. And you're on The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn with Lori Lynn and Rick Wilson. And this week, we're going to talk to a West Virginia native who is of Arab American descent. And he has a very unique perspective, I think, on the Trump election. His name is Sharif Youssef. He's a young man who is also a producer for the hit podcast 99% Invisible. Hey, Sharif, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You wrote this really great Facebook post, and you can find it on our website, wvpublic.org. But what motivated you to talk about both growing up in West Virginia and your feelings about being a West Virginian and living in the Bay Area?
I think that what motivated me was I think I have a very unique perspective on this election. I come from three very distinct places that I have ties to: Egypt, West Virginia, and Yale University. And all three are so distinct culturally as to be almost different countries. I tend to be very liberal, very progressive, and my Facebook feed is filled with other liberals and progressive thanks to Facebook's algorithms. So I saw a lot of heartache and disappointment after the election, and I felt that. I felt pretty terrified, not so much for me because I am white passing, but for my father, who teaches physics to people who don't really want to learn physics, so he already has some animosity built into his job, but also lives in a very rural area in West Liberty, West Virginia. I felt scared for my friends of color and for my queer, genderqueer, trans friends and acquaintances and for the strangers who I don't know but whom I can sympathize and empathize with. And because I went to these liberal places like Yale and the Bay Area where I live now, I also see the sort of condescension that often is associated with West Virginia and Appalachia. When I told people I came from West Virginia, that I went to high school in West Virginia at Yale, it would sometimes be followed by a slight silence or an, "Oh, what was that like?" Or, "You don't seem like a West Virginian," which was condescending because I knew that in their mind they had this really stereotypical vision of a West Virginian with like rotting teeth and morbidly obese and really dumb. And while I don't agree with that, while I certainly don't think that's true of all West Virginians by a long shot, I took it as a compliment that they didn't think I was that. Yeah, I just thought that perhaps sharing my perspectives on being discriminated against in West Virginia, my perspectives of going to a liberal elite college and having similar condescension, showing that that stuff still exists outside of places that are more stereotypically discriminatory, I thought that unique perspective would be something that people would get some value and insight from.
Let me ask you, you talked a little bit in your essay about your experiences with people not being very tolerant of your religion when you were growing up in the Northern Panhandle. And what's it like? What actually happened to you?
I experienced everything from like people in middle school like following me around the hallways, calling me a terrorist, to more subtle things like during Ramadan, which I practiced in middle school, people would sort of go out of their way to like ask me like, "Why are you doing this? Just eat something. Your dad won't know." And I'm like, "Oh, it's not about like whether my dad would know." They're like, "Oh, whatever." So having like your religion sort of cast aside, despite me not trying to like influence others to join it or whatever, was hurtful. I was harassed on the school bus going home. People would call me towelhead. People would call me like camel jockey. Some people would use worse words than that, that I'm not sure if I should say on air. This unsettled feeling of never quite feeling at home is probably like the sense I get the most when I think about that stuff happening.
What's the word that you didn't want to say that people called you?
I've been called nigger. I was called sand nigger. The nigger thing sort of confused me. It was also, I remember distinctly that time because the other ones happened with much more frequency that they sort of blurred together and I've tried to block them out. But that one in particular, I remember because I had just moved back to America. So I was in third grade and we were like taking a test or like doing something at our desk. And this like one kid just like looked over at me. He's like, "Hey, you're black." And I was like, "I'm not. I don't identify as black. I'm not sub-Saharan African. I am pasty by white people standards, let alone brown people standards." So I was like really confused. And he just said, "Hey, you're black. You're a nigger." I don't think I knew what that word was, but I could tell that it was something really hateful, and I could tell that it was connected with black people by, like, the way he connected those dots. And I just, like, was sitting in my desk and, like, sort of, like, shaking, and I didn't know what to do. And I was, like, sort of crying a little bit. I don't really remember what happened or if I told the teacher or if I told my parents, my father. He was already dealing with enough stuff that I didn't really feel like bothering him anymore. But, yeah, that stuff hurt a lot.
I was wondering how your experience changed at specific critical times, for example, around 9/11. Was it an issue before that in your memory? I know you're not as old as I am in the buildup of the Iraq War. You know, just how did it fluctuate in terms of public events?
Sure. I would say 9/11 was definitely a catalyzing point. That happened when I was in fourth grade, and then middle schools was fifth grade to eighth grade. So I remember, like, most distinctly in middle school, partly because in middle school it got a bunch of different elementary schools sending all the kids to the same place. So maybe the people in fourth grade who, like, knew me better and knew that, like, I didn't have a hateful bone in my body might have been more tolerant. And then in middle school, getting other people in, hearing the name Sharif Youssef, looking at my dark features, like my dark eyebrows, my dark hair, I think that was definitely a catalyst. Looking back, I think my dad got his citizenship. He's a citizen of the United States. I think he got it in, like, the winter of 2001. So he was planning on doing it anyway, but I think 9/11 probably helped light a fire under him and was like, oh, this might go south quick, so I better get on this. So yeah, 9/11 definitely affected me pretty profoundly.
So your dad still lives here. You've moved out to the Bay Area to a very successful career as a producer. Does your dad have a different view of living in West Virginia than you do? Because you seem to have a pretty dismal view of the place based on how you were treated while you were growing up here.
Dismal in some senses, but, like, the community that I did have were really kind and friendly, and people, like, often went out of their way to say hi to each other, and I really appreciated that. My dad, like, ran over a small rock in his car with me in it, and, like, our tire went flat, and someone saw us and, like, took us to their house, and they had, like, a garage filled with tools and helped change the tire. That's stuff that is, like, really special to me that you can't find just anywhere, and that's something that I really do love about West Virginia. But I talked to my father and his wife, Linda, on the phone, my stepmother. He's not, like, a very social person. Like, he pretty much works and then stays home and plays with the cats. So he doesn't have to interact with a whole lot of people that he doesn't have to. But I've seen people, like, look at him with, like, I don't know, shady eyes in Kroger. So I know, like, that stuff exists towards him. But I think first generations or immigrants in particular have a different view of racism because they're just, like, more used to it. So I think he does have a view of, like, okay, this might be, like, a tough 4 years. One thing that he said that was pretty profound that I hadn't really thought about, he's like, I grew up in Egypt where Hosni Mubarak had been reigning for many years, and he was just like, I just had to accept that. We didn't really have a say in what happened. We just had to accept corrupt leaders if they were thrust upon us. Despite the election not going the way he would have wanted, he was like, it's kind of cool that in a democratic republic, something won't go your way pretty frequently, but at least you have a say in it. And that was something that I didn't really think about too much because I was too young to think about politics when I did live in Egypt.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more from Sharif Youssef, a West Virginia native and a producer for the hit podcast 99% Invisible, who happens also to be an Arab American. He's going to talk more about his mixed feelings toward this election. But first, it's a good time to remind ourselves after the long and contentious debates what our values are. What are the values of public media? We believe in civil conversation. We believe the truth matters. We believe in the dignity of every person's story. This is what public broadcasting is all about. And this is what you support when you watch, listen, and donate to our station. Thank you for helping to tell West Virginia's story. And we're back with Sharif Youssef. He is an Arab-American young man, grew up in the northern panhandle of West Virginia, among other places, and now is a producer for the hit podcast 99% Invisible. He's talking about his reaction to the election of Donald Trump. Sharif, there's been a lot of commentary about Trump voters, obviously, and Jamel Bowie from Slate has an article that's entitled "There's No Such Thing as a Good Trump Voter," and basically says that people voted for a racist who promised racist outcomes and they don't deserve your empathy. So it seems like for the folks that are opposed to Trump, there are two different schools of thoughts now. And one school of thought basically is that. It was like, don't try to understand these people. They voted for a racist. Therefore, they are racist, whether they say so or not. And our goal is to defeat them. And there's another school of thought that says, no, we have to try to understand the underlying, you know, motivations and that they're not all racist. You can understand Trump voters in West Virginia getting their backs up about saying, well, that you're racist because you voted for Trump. And they'll say no. So where do you stand on that divide?
Yeah, I skimmed that article, and I also read another article from, I think, a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison who actually went to rural communities and sat with them for longer than like an hour and kept going back and talking to them and hearing what they had to say about the divide between rural and urban. And I honestly like don't know. I think understanding people regardless of politics is really important. This has been helpful talking to you guys who are still in West Virginia to like understand your perspective on things. Hopefully hearing mine are illuminating in some way too. But at the same time, like Trump espoused so much hatred, like not even remotely censored, like admitting to sexual assault, creating a national registry for people who have a different religion, banning all immigration, deporting millions of people. So like in a way, I do see that as like voting for him as implicit condoning of his behavior. But to be honest, I think the narrative of like it was poor, racist white people who elected Trump to president is false. Hillary Clinton, the only income brackets that she won were people who made 50 grand or less a year. But every other income bracket voted for Trump. So I think like not everyone who voted for Trump was a racist. I think some of the people were, for sure. But I think a lot of people saw that like he was just using rhetoric to gain bigoted support that he needed to win the election. And then it was other people who were like, okay, he probably won't actually be able to do a lot of this stuff, but I'm going to vote for him because it will decrease my taxes. I think that is also a narrative that's not getting enough play in the media.
Sharif, you talked about being scared and apprehensive for, you know, friends of color, women friends. One question I have, and I've seen some people raise this, you know, would you be saying the same thing if a different Republican had won the presidency? Say Marco Rubio was the president-elect right now. Wouldn't a lot of the same people who are expressing fear about Trump be saying exactly the same thing about really any Republican?
I think in terms of some policies, there are some that might have similar views on immigration, similar views on same-sex marriage. But it's really unprecedented how explicitly sexist, how explicitly xenophobic, how explicitly Islamophobic Donald Trump is. And honestly, I'm fearful of like the Muslim registry and maybe perhaps my family from Egypt never being able to come visit during his reign. But I'm more frightened for the people who feel emboldened by his sentiments from the people who share these racist views, which I recognize not all Trump supporters support, but the people who do, the minority who do, have their really terrible thoughts and impulses legitimized by his candidacy in a way that wouldn't have happened with someone like Rubio.
Sharif, some people, you know, they look at the college students, you know, marching and giving out hugs and needing safe spaces, and they say, you know, this is just an overreaction, and this is the kind of thing that culturally turns off people to the left and makes them vote for Trump. People in, you know, not just Appalachia, but, you know, the Rust Belt, the folks that the Democrats need to win back being turned off by what they perceive as an overreaction to the Trump victory. I mean, do you worry about that at all?
I think the protests in the wake of Trump victory are very important, actually. I don't think it's going to overrule anything, but I think it's important to send a message to the rest of the world that America doesn't stand behind the vitriol that he espoused. The other thing is, in terms of like people shutting down, I think there's a much larger issue within the Democratic Party or with a liberal elite population than people protesting things like that. I think that working class people haven't had a candidate to really rally for them in this election. And I think that in order to like try to do that in terms of like Rust Belt states and Appalachian states, the Democratic Party or another party, I think the two-party system's kind of messed up, needs to focus more on what those people actually want in terms of like bringing industry or finding other places for them to work. I don't buy that it's just people saying like, oh, look at these like touchy-feely college people who need to like not look at racist costumes. I think policy that addresses real economic need is a much more viable solution than telling people not to express themselves when they feel unsafe.
So one of the goals of West Virginia Public Broadcasting in a state that's not very diverse is to try to get people to think about diversity and to think about people who are different from them. And yes, it's, you know, understand and accept them too. So can you, someone who grew up here and was sometimes accepted and sometimes not, what could we be doing better here to help West Virginians to be more accepting?
It's really hard to gain firsthand perspective when there aren't a whole lot of communities of color, because I think a lot of people just go by what they see on the news or what they see on some fake news sites that have been proliferating and Facebook and Google ads. If you do have access to those communities, you should try to talk to them. I realize a lot of people don't. And I think the next best thing would be to educate yourself, inform yourself. Like, I'm starting to read Hillbilly Elegy to like more fully understand the nuances of Appalachia and someone who grew up really, really poor. I think a lot of people in West Virginia might benefit from reading Ta-Nehisi Coates or expanding their news sources to things like MSNBC instead of just Fox and Breitbart, which I put news in quotation marks for that one. Just doing whatever you can to educate and inform yourself. Which was part of the goal of why I wrote my original post on Facebook.
Sharif, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you guys for having me.
All right, Rick, what's your Bible verse for the week?
Well, we've heard the word racism a lot in this episode, and there's no denying that racism is alive and well. There's no denying that West Virginia is often associated with that, unfortunately. So the verse I'm thinking about right now is from chapter 17 of Acts of the Apostles, that God has made of one blood all the people of the earth. And I did go to church last Sunday, Lori, so back off.
Congratulations.
And that's The Front Porch for this week. I'm Scott Finn with Rick Wilson and Lori Lynn. And thanks especially to Sharif Youssef. He's a West Virginia native, producer for 99% Invisible, Arab American, and a very brave person for being able and willing to open up on these really contentious issues. Oh, wait, one more thing. I promised my former English teacher, James Lippold, that I would read a little comment from him. So Mr. Lippold is listening right now. He's in Iowa. And I asked him, what happened? You know, this is a state that went for Obama twice in a big way, and then an equally big way for Trump in this election. He says, I think the insurance cost increases were ill-timed. The Bernie-Hillary split did not fully heal. The FBI did a real job on Hillary, and she is not the warm and fuzzy person who draws in the millennial voters. I also think a lot of people wanted to prove they were not racist when Obama ran. Lots of reasons. So, you know, that's where I sharpened my rhetorical, you know, skills was in Mr. Lippold's speech classes. And as usual, he gets right to the point. So thanks for helping us understand what Iowa voters are going through there, Mr. Lippold. And if you want to talk back to us, feel free, please. You should tweet at us, which is at Radio Finn.
At El Cabrero.
And at WV Pundit.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.